Chapter 16. I had no sooner entered the hall than I encountered Stoker, still dressed in his frock coat, wrenching his collar free from his shirt, neckcloth in hand. He stared in consternation at my dishevelment.
"Veronica, what has befallen you?"
He would have embraced me, but I put up a hand to prevent him. "Do not touch me. I am dripping in more mud," I said. "I am unhurt, merely a mishap."
"A mishap? You are covered from brow to boot in the stuff,"
he added, wiping a thumb over my cheek. "I was careless," I said truthfully. "I stepped into a bog. No matter, I extricated myself. Nothing lost but my pride and my equipment," I added, brandishing the pieces of my broken net.
"You have others,"
he said, by way of consolation. But this was my favourite. I could only afford the most inferior equipment on my first expedition, but with the sale of a rather spectacular set of lunar moths, I was able to afford this, I explained, looking at the sad ruins. "A net is not merely a lepidopterist's tool in trade. Over rills and rocks, through meadow and marsh, the net is never out of one's hand. It is the constant companion, the partner in chase, the accomplice in victory. I had carried this particular net for 6 years. Next to the tiny grey velvet mouse in my pocket, a legacy from the father who would not acknowledge me, it was my most treasured possession. Nay, not possession, friend. My net knew my failures. It had witnessed the places where my courage had deserted me. But it knew also my triumphs, the moments when I had faced down insurmountable adversaries and set my teeth against the storm, determined to carry the day. He glanced about, to make certain we were alone, I think, for he pitched his voice low.
"Mrs. Desmond said Jonathan Hathaway has gone for a walk upon the moor. Did you see him?"
"I did," I admitted. I had no wish to expand upon the conversation, but with the windows of the house overlooking the moor, it was entirely possible that we had been spotted.
"And?"
Stoker pressed, his expression searching.
"Were you able to form any conclusions as to his veracity?"
"I cannot say," I replied. He thrust an impatient hand into his hair.
"I suppose that is understandable. You last saw him under extraordinary circumstances more than half a decade ago. People change."
"But still, you wish I had a more definitive answer to give you," I suggested. He smiled obliquely.
"I am content to remain with my thylacine for as long as it takes to secure him for travel. But the minute he is safely packed, I shall want him back in London, so I can examine him properly."
I silently cursed the thylacine, even as I fretted over Harry Spenlove's true motivations in playing at being Jonathan Hathaway. When I was with him, it was entirely possible to believe his intentions were semi-honourable. To come to tranquil rest after years of racketing around the world, to enjoy the benevolent affections of a grandmotherly figure, these were understandable, even laudable intentions. Upon occasion, in the darkest of the small hours of morning, I would lie awake and wonder how I had come to be enthralled by such a devious and unprincipled character. He had charm, to be sure, and a certain vivacity one could not help but admire. And yet, alone, personal attractions had not been enough to win my hand. I was too wary, too like a butterfly, content to sample the many delectable offerings in a field of particularly enticing specimens. But Harry had been different, and with a rush of unpleasant self-knowledge, I understood why. Like Stoker, he had a slender ribbon of pain woven into the fabric of his soul. He troubled to conceal his, Whilst Stoker, when I met him, was content to display his foul temper to anyone, but the root of the suffering was the same. Abandonment. Two such different men, yet their wounds were very nearly identical. I had been drawn to them as wounded things, not to heal them, but because I sensed in them kindred spirits, for my own soul bore lacerations of its own, and with that realization came a sudden and ungovernable anger. I had existed, in almost perfect contentment, for quite a long time without that knowledge, and the implacable storm of it breaking so swiftly over my head left me adrift. For a tuppence, I would have boarded the first train out of Shepton Parva and left them all. "Will it matter?" I burst out.
"Will what matter? The thylacine? Of course it does. The thing is damned near extinct in the wild. Getting hold of a trophy like this one is the find of a decade for a natural historian," he said.
I rolled my eyes in exasperation. "Not the thylacine. Jonathan Hathaway. What if I cannot ever say with certainty it is or is not he?" Stoker thought a moment, then shrugged.
"I suppose if you cannot, then it may not be helped. Perhaps Sir Hugo can find someone else who knew him. A school friend? Another travelling companion?"
"But it might be too late at that point," I said. "If he is a villain, bent upon some scheme, he may already have accomplished his aims and preyed upon this family."
"How?"
he asked bluntly.
"His grandfather's will was quite specific. With Jonathan Hathaway dead, Charles inherits all. Now that Jonathan is come back, if it is indeed he cannot take the house. He cannot get his hands on any of Mary Hathaway's money, for that comes from her father. The land goes with the house, and I suppose with expensive legal counsel he might make a claim for a few head of sheep. But I cannot fancy him with a shepherd's crook and a dog at his heels,"
he added with a smile. "No, nor can I. But there are valuable things in Sir Geoffrey's collection," I began. I was thinking aloud, torn between my desire to protect Harry from his own worst impulses and my duty to expose him for what he was. Neither prospect filled me with pleasure, and I was unaccountably irritated with Stoker that he had not intuited my unsettled feelings. "What," I began to wonder, "was the point of allowing a gentleman access to one's bed and heart if he could not interpret a lady's most irrational moods?" He went on, just as if I were not standing in front of him, glowering like a thundercloud.
"Of course, any zoologist would know. The thylacine is the most precious thing in the house, but it will take a proper crate and a few men to move it. And even if he managed to lay hands upon it, what would he do with it? There is no one to whom he could possibly sell it if he wanted to retrieve even half its value without us getting word of it. The world of natural history is a small one,"
he reminded me,
"and he is not known within its confines. Too many have been swindled by fakery. Collectors with money to burn are cautious now. It is no longer the heady days of Mr. Barnum and the Fiji Mermaid."
I shuddered, thinking of Mr. Barnum's repellent specimen. He had presented it during the height of the fashion for cryptids, creatures half out of myth, displayed to a gullible public audience for the price of a small coin. This particular item had been fashioned from sewing a fish's tail to the torso of a monkey. One look at the thing, and any person of science would have rejected it out of hand, but the average individual yearning for entertainment would be more persuaded by novelty than accuracy. There had been a fad for such things after the publication of Mr. Darwin's text. When On the Origin of Species had first burst upon the scene, many misread its premise of a common ancestor shared by man and ape to mean that men were descended from monkeys. A perfectly ludicrous notion. But the idea was just sensational enough to persuade people to part with their hard-earned money to see proofs in the shape of horrible hominids, patchwork mannequins fashioned of simian limbs and human features. The fact that such grotesqueries were displayed at fairgrounds and pleasure palaces instead of respectable scientific institutions should have been sufficient to ensure their ridicule. But too often I had seen perfectly intelligent and rational people convinced by one of these repellent fakeries. Our intrepid journalist acquaintance, J.J. Butterworth, had even written a series of articles after spending a fortnight with a travelling show. She had pasted false hair onto her face and arms and displayed herself under the bill of the Ape Woman of Nova Scotia, for which she was paid the princely sum of £10. Before I could return to the subject of Jonathan Hathaway, Stoker dropped a heavy hand to my shoulder.
In any event, all you promised Sir Hugo was that you would try. You made him no guarantees of success,
he reminded me. He dropped his hand and gathered up his stack of paper parcels. Several were marked with the label of a scientific supplier, but the smallest bore a bright red and white string and an illustration of a dancing sweet.
Honey drops,
he said, grinning.
And now I am for my thylacine,
he told me, with an unholy light in his eyes. I might have stopped him then, told him I had something of importance to discuss, but his attention had already wandered. He was with his thylacine. I had noted the use of the possessive pronoun. Whatever price Lord Rosemoran paid for it, I was certain Stoker would always take a proprietary interest in the beast. Go on, then, I said, forcing a smile to my lips. I must clean myself before I befoul Mrs. Desmond's carpets any further. He left me then, in a swirl of frock coat and honey drops. I made my way to my room on leaden feet, but in half an hour I had rung for hot water and washed myself thoroughly, dressing in my blue gown once more and sending my tweeds down to be cleaned along with my boots. The pieces of my butterfly net were wrapped in a spare petticoat, with the same reverence the Egyptians of old gave to their mummies. I laid the bundle in my carpet bag with a sigh of regret. That net had collected as many memories as butterflies, trekking the lush foothills of the Andean Alps, venturing to islands beyond the edge of the world, sunrises and sunsets and every moment in between. How I missed my adventures. I dashed away a sudden bit of moisture from my eyes and stiffened my spine. This would never do. Being with Harry had resurrected so many ghosts, and my emotions were in tumult as they had never been before. I had prided myself on knowing precisely who I was and what I believed. Yet in the 2 years since I had come to London, that had been tested over and again. The bond between my image of myself and my own identity stretched until it had at last snapped. I would have said firmly and without hesitation that I was a forthright person who valued honesty and plain speaking, that I would stride boldly into difficult situations and face them head on, prepared to take my stand whatever the cost. Instead, I found myself beset by emotion at the sight of a broken butterfly net, hiding in my room as I kept a terrible secret from the one person I ought to have told. Why this devilish concealment? Was it pure cowardice? I searched my heart and found that it was not reluctance to endure Stoker's wrath which decided my course. I had withstood his temper often enough. In fact, I have admitted in the pages of my recorded adventures more than once that I found his displays of spleen to be invigorating, as his eyes shone and his muscles flexed with indignation or fury. Had I any expectation of his committing any violence, it would not have been so, but Stoker, more than any person of my acquaintance, would never harm me. I knew that as well as I knew my own name. He was incapable of inflicting suffering upon me. But oh, how I despised myself for inflicting it upon him. I knew that concealing my past from him would divide us, but the truth would be wounding, I had no doubt of it. It would come as a blow, both the fact of my marriage and the fact of its concealment. I would have to deliver the strike in a time and place that would permit him the agonies he would no doubt experience. Anger, wounded pride, betrayal. These were uneasy sentiments, and he deserved to grapple with them privately, not in the company of strangers such as the Hathaways. At least, that is what I told myself as I left my room, justifying my choice to delay telling him the truth. I was also mindful of Jonathan's, how quickly I had come to think of him by that name, unsubtle hints as to his intentions should I reveal his secrets. I split no hairs. I appreciated no sophistry. He could twist it however he liked, but the plain fact was that he had chosen blackmail. He trusted not in my long-dead affection for him, but in the fervour of my feelings for Stoker, to shield him from the consequences of whatever crimes he chose to perpetrate. And for all his pretty speeches about Lady Hathaway and new beginnings, I did suspect he nurtured some less wholesome scheme to divide that lady from her wealth. There was only one proper course to be taken, I decided. In order to protect Stoker for as long as possible, and to keep Lady Hathaway from becoming the victim of Jonathan's villainous plot, I would have to remain at Hathaway Hall, keeping a watchful eye upon everyone, ready to unleash my own particular hell in defence of those who did not understand what sort of viper they nursed within their bosom. Refreshed, if not wholly persuaded by my logic, I am keenly aware of my own hypocrisies even as I indulge them, I bathed my tear-swollen eyes and dressed for dinner in the one silk gown I had brought. It had been freshly sponged and returned to my room, and I fancied the violet silk flattered my eyes and skin. I took extra care with my hair, plaiting and coiling it atop my head. I felt once more in possession of myself, and it was with fresh resolve that I descended to dinner, determined to keep a firm grip upon my emotions and apply rational principles to my situation. I would watch Jonathan, Harry, I corrected myself sternly, with the keenness of a raptor. I would harden my heart against his protestations of innocence, and remind myself that he had engaged in a polite exercise of extortion in order to get me to do his bidding. Well, two could play at that sort of game, I decided. All I required was to find the weakness in his armour. I am, it has been noted by criminals of the loftiest distinction, a worthy adversary, and although it would pain me to view Harry in that light, I would balk at nothing to keep Stoker free from his clutches. Thus determined, I went to dinner in a mood of dangerous optimism. Chapter 17. I was, unfortunately, destined for disappointment. Harry was, in a word, delightful. He flattered Mary, complimenting the dinner as well as the elegance of the table, although both were entirely due to the efforts of the sterling Mrs. Desmond. He asked thoughtful questions of Charles about sheep, and insightful questions of Stoker about advances in the taxidermical arts. He attended Lady Hathaway with a closeness that would have been called fawning under other circumstances. He even, I was nauseated to see, indulged his erstwhile nephew and nieces when they appeared, washed and brushed and dressed in starched nightgowns to present their scrubbed cheeks for kisses before they retired for the night. He permitted little Ada to search his pockets for sweets, while urging young Geoffrey to display the gruesome little cage and its new inhabitant, an unlucky mouse. Even Effie came under his spell, as he expressed interest in viewing the rising moon through her decrepit telescope before it began to wane. He flattered, he cajoled, he entertained. In short, he had them nibbling from his palm. And the occasional glance he darted my way, a blandly innocent look delivered from under his demurely lowered lashes, showed that he knew exactly what he was doing. He even forestalled my plan to speak with Stoker by challenging him to another game of billiards. Stoker hesitated, looking at me, but Harry went on, smiling.
"You must allow me the chance to win back the money you took from me last night," he said, laughing. "It is only sporting."
If there is one thing against which an Englishman is powerless, it is being thought unsporting. Stoker gave me a shrug and followed Harry into the billiards room, whilst I took myself upstairs for a sulk. I was determined to wait up as long as it might take to speak privately with Stoker, although I knew Harry would do everything in his power to prevent it. So I took up a book, the latest Arcadia Brown adventure, filched from Stoker's carpet bag, and resumed my post in the window seat, fully dressed. The moon was high, peeking out from behind the scudding clouds and shedding a silvery glow upon the gardens below. My book proved rather less interesting than I had anticipated, no fault of the intrepid Arcadia, who was on the hunt for a villainous wretch who had abducted her sidekick and loyal companion, Garvin, and I found myself watching instead the shifting shadows. As I peered into the darkness, one of the shadows seemed to detach from the stone wall, moving into the moonlight, gliding over the dew-spangled grass. I watched as it drifted in the direction of the summer house at the end of the gardens. From my perch, I could see the edge of the moor beyond, a vast, inky emptiness. It was uncanny enough in the daylight, but at that hour, it seemed not entirely impossible that it might play host to all manner of spectral things. As if conjured by my very thoughts, at that moment a tiny ball of light appeared on the moor. It proceeded towards the summer house, growing larger as it came closer, bouncing erratically, as if propelled by some supernatural movement. Light upon the moor could well be a shepherd searching for a lost lamb, but a lantern would have shed warm yellow light. This illumination was fed by cold fire, a chill and lifeless blue light that glowed with an unnatural fury. I threw down my book and took to my heels, blessing the instinct that had caused me to remain dressed. I had no weapon, for what weapons may one employ against the spectral? I had no light, and as I pounded down the stairs to the garden door, I realized I needed none. The clerestory windows permitted enough illumination to guide my way, and I found the garden door unlocked and standing slightly ajar. I burst through, putting on as much speed as my evening frock and thin slippers would permit. I had gathered the skirts into one hand, lifting them free of my feet, but I tripped, nonetheless, just as I emerged into the garden and fell heavily. I swore loudly and looked ahead to where the dark, cloaked figure was just opening the summer house door. It turned and seemed to stare directly at me from across the green sward, its face shrouded in the shadows from its hood. "Hold there," I ordered. The figure in black seemed to hesitate upon the threshold of the summer house, indecision writ in every line of its posture. "There is a spectral ball of light upon the moor," I cried, forcing myself to my feet. Even as I spoke, the blue light approached the summer house door that led out to the moor. The figure in black turned and seemed to shrink away from the light as it came near.
"Go away," called a feminine voice. "You are not wanted here."
I rushed ahead to where Anjali, for I recognized from the voice it was she in the black cloak, trembled upon the threshold of the summer house. As I ran, I heard a dull rattle and wondered if the phantom was attempting to enter the summer house. Gathering my skirts well above my knees, I hurtled past Anjali and into the summer house, giving an imitation of a Viking berserker cry. I have, upon occasion, had recourse to employ the battle cries of the Maori, the Celt, and several of the indigenous peoples of the Americas. I have found them all equally effective. In this instance, the orb of blue light seemed to float, then vanish before my very eyes. I would have given chase, but behind me, Anjali emitted a shriek and fell heavily into a swoon. "Anjali!" I cried, gathering her into my arms. She was entirely unconscious, but seemed otherwise unharmed. Just then, Stoker and Jonathan burst into the garden through the door from the billiards room.
"Veronica!"
Stoker exclaimed, dropping to his knees beside me.
"Are you all right?"
"I am fine, but we must pursue the apparition. It was a ball of blue light," I insisted, pointing in the direction it had vanished. Stoker leapt into action, while I thrust Anjali into Jonathan's arms and commanded him to look after her. "Mind you do not let her take cold," I added, as I pushed myself to my feet and followed hard upon Stoker's heels. He had stopped just beyond the summer house, peering into the bleak emptiness of the moor. I shoved past him, feeling the stone-strewn grasses beneath my slippers. This was where the landscaped order of the gardens gave way to the empty wildness of the moors beyond. They stretched like some sort of alien world, the menhirs silvery white against the ceaselessly moving darkness of the terrain. Of the phantom orb there was no sign. I peered into the night, straining my eyes for any sign of the spectral presence. "Perhaps behind one of the stones," I said, starting towards the nearest. Stoker grasped my arm.
"Don't be a fool. You cannot possibly venture onto the moors at night. It would be suicide."
I made to wriggle free, but he held my arm fast. "Trat and damnation," I muttered. But, of course, he was correct. I recalled my own unfortunate experience with a bit of mire earlier that day. Only experience and a steady nerve had seen me out of it safely. Rushing in the dark would be unspeakably foolish and unnecessarily dangerous. With bad grace, I returned with Stoker to the gardens, where Jonathan had carried the still senseless Anjali. He looked up with anxious eyes.
"What is wrong with her?" "Shock, I imagine,"
Stoker told him. He put a finger to her pulse and listened to her breathing.
"Her pulse is quick but strong. I can find no injury. Carry her inside so she does not take a chill. She cannot remain upon this damp grass."
Jonathan struggled to his feet, upon which Stoker reached out and swung the motionless form into his arms with as little fuss as if she were a feather.
"What the devil is all the furor about?"
Charles Hathaway, imperfectly attired in nightshirt and hastily donned trousers, a nightcap settled askew on his head, lifted a lantern as he emerged from the house. "It was a phantom, Mr. Hathaway," I told him.
"Phantom?"
It was too dark to see properly, but I was certain he had paled at the word. "An orb of blue," I added helpfully. "I saw it as plainly as I see you now. Anjali did as well, and the sight frightened her so badly she collapsed."
"Ruin,"
Charles Hathaway said faintly.
It means ruin to see one of the phantoms of the moor.
I went to him and pinched him hard upon the arm, at which he jumped.
Madam!
You looked decidedly unwell, and we simply cannot have two people unconscious at once, I told him.
I am composed now,
he said, although his voice still quavered. Good. I turned once more to Anjali, who was beginning to stir in Stoker's arms. Upstairs with her. I presume she has a room near Lady Hathaway's in case she is needed in the night. Charles Hathaway confirmed this, and we made our way inside, a strange little procession. He paused at the doorway and gestured for Stoker to carry her inside. Stoker settled her gently on the bed. Leave me to it, I instructed. This is woman's work. He hesitated.
She may be distressed when she regains her senses.
I will not leave her, I promised. I looked at Charles Hathaway. You might send Effie, in case she requires anything. He nodded, seeming glad to have something to do. Jonathan had melted away, but I was not surprised. Harry Spenlove had never been good in a crisis, I reflected bitterly. Stoker offered once more to help, but I waved him off, conscious that this was hardly the time to embark upon the discussion that was now long overdue. I glanced about the room. It was small and stingily furnished, with a narrow bed and a table and chair, neither of which matched the washstand. A thin screen across one corner of the chamber was the only concession to privacy. The Hathaways were the sort of folk who did not even permit a lock upon the door for the servants, I noticed with a rush of resentment on Anjali's behalf. I went to the small hearth and poked up the fire that had fallen to ash, building it until it could take a few tiny logs. It made only a little difference to the chill of the room. Anjali was lying motionless upon the bed cover where Stoker had placed her. She, like me, was fully dressed. I removed her damp shoes and set them near the fire, but not near enough to scorch. Her hem was wet as well, and the back of her dress. I should have to wrestle her out of her sodden things, but it would go a good deal easier if she were awake. Although I was in evening dress, I am never entirely unprepared for misadventure, and I reached for the narrow blade that rested in a tiny scabbard tucked into my décolletage. I unpinned a lock of my hair, and in one quick motion sliced off the last few inches. It was quick work to twist the hair into a knot and set it on fire. I waved the burning knot under her nose, and she came to at once, choking a little against the smell. She asked no questions, but simply stared up at the ceiling for a long moment.
I must have fallen senseless, she said at last. What happened?
It was the question of every swooning heroine in every gothic novel. I had little patience with the predictability of it, and conducted a swift evaluation of her physical state whilst I replied. Mr. Templeton Vane carried you, I informed her. I peered into her pupils, but they were the same size, large in the dim light of the room. We found you in a state of collapse in the garden. Did you strike your head when you fell? I asked.
I do not believe so, she told me.
I reached a hand to the back of her head, probing. I feel no lumps or abrasions, I said at last. That is good. How is your vision?
Perfectly fine, she assured me.
Headache? I pressed. Rebellious stomach? Trembling? She put out her hand, and I saw that it did not move.
I am well, thank you.
Good. You need out of those wet things, I said. She sat up, and I would have helped her disrobe, but she hurried behind the screen and removed her dress and stockings. I brought her a thin flannel wrapper, and she clutched it about herself as I draped the dress and stockings over the screen to dry.
You are very kind, Miss Speedwell, she said, smiling faintly. I settled her onto the bed and took advantage of her gratitude to sit beside her. What did you see before you collapsed? She opened her mouth, then closed it sharply and shook her head. It might help you to speak of it, I urged. I saw nothing, she said, her mouth set mulishly. Just then, Effie Hathaway appeared, her freckles standing out in sharp relief in her pale face. Aunt Charlie, are you ill? Charles said you had taken a tumble in the garden. What on earth were you doing outside this time of night? She went to the bed, and Anjali gripped her hand, the knuckles going quite pale. I am quite well. I did not mean to disturb anyone. Her ladyship...
Grana is snoring, Effie assured her. It would take the opening of the seventh seal to awaken her.
Anjali gave her a small smile. I am glad. She closed her eyes then, and Effie put a hand to her brow.
No fever, thank heaven, but I still do not understand, she began.
It is nothing, Anjali told her sharply. She gave Effie a meaningful look, and they fell into an uneasy silence. Since neither of them seemed inclined to speak again, I rose. If you mean to stay with Anjali, then I will leave, I said. From the bed, Anjali murmured her thanks, and I beckoned Effie to step outside the room with me. She pulled the door almost closed behind us, leaving only a small crack.
I will stay with her, she said.
I nodded. I will be brief. Anjali saw a phantom orb, a sort of ball of blue light on the moor, I told her. Effie's colour sharpened suddenly, bright ruddy spots rising in each cheek.
Did you see it as well?
She demanded. I did. I pursued it, but it vanished upon the moor.
You pursued it, but it was a phantom, Effie protested. You ought to have been too frightened to attempt it.
And you are a woman of science, which means you ought to know it is likely some phenomenon of a natural variety, I replied. Whilst I was perfectly willing to entertain all possibilities, I found myself taking a decidedly contrarian position with Effie. Her insistence that the moor was full of supernatural creatures had no doubt been intended to provoke reactions in the Hathaway children, but it seemed Anjali had fallen victim to the notion of such horrors as well. Such a dramatic reaction was surely the result of a mild hysteria, certainly stoked by Effie's haunted tales of the macabre. She must have been thinking along similar lines, for she coloured slightly.
I know it is irrational and contradicts all that we know of logic and reason, and yet...
She paused and glanced outside the window to where the moon hung, full and ripe.
I am a modern woman, like you, Miss Speedwell, but I was reared here, and the moor is full of ghostly tales. Runaway coaches with phantom horses, highwaymen who ride in search of their heads, and our own grey lady and black dog. I have told the children the stories, but I confess I cannot help but sometimes wonder if perhaps there is not a grain of truth to these legends.
She looked very young just then, her freckles standing out starkly against her white skin as the flush ebbed from her cheeks. I felt a rush of pity for her, particularly when I considered that the woman lying on the bed was perhaps her only friend in the house. Atmosphere and setting can make believers of us all, I said, in what I hoped was a gracious tone. The truth was, I had often expressed just such a notion to Stoker, much to his amusement. I was unwilling to dismiss all things supernatural simply because we had no explanation for them. Effie gave me a level look.
No doubt you think me very foolish.
I understand how easily one's belief in the rational world may be overcome by the sight of something spectral. This was an uncanny apparition. But you do not believe it was an apparition, she pressed. What do you think it was? You must have some thoughts on the matter. I shrugged. I do not say that such things are utterly impossible, but this particular manifestation was making use of the door to the summer house. Why should it have need of such a thing if it were indeed incorporeal? Effie continued to stare at me, her hands working into small fists at her sides. I do not know, but I can tell you that it is supposed to be an omen of evil tidings to this family when such things are seen. Everyone in these parts knows that. The sensible thing when something frightful is abroad on the moor is to lock your doors and draw your curtains. Surely such precautions are pointless against an entity which is completely supernatural, I argued. Ghosts and phantoms do not exactly stop at locks and doors. No, but you are supposed to stay inside and leave such things strictly alone, she said stubbornly. I reflected that Effie, like all the Hathaways, had a considerable exasperating streak. She seemed annoyed that I questioned the spectre, and yet she was the one who had warned me of such things to begin with. Perhaps, I decided, she was a little embarrassed at being a woman of science who indulged in such superstitious fancies. Suddenly, it all seemed terribly pointless, and I realized I was very tired after my earlier exertions on the moor. I longed for nothing as much as the comforts of my bed just then. Is there anything more I can do for Anjali? If not, I shall leave her in your hands. Effie shook her head, her expression relieved. No doubt that I was not pressing her further on the matter of scientific inquiry where the phantom was concerned. You have already been most kind, Miss Speedwell. It was understandable. I myself found the spectre unnerving, I assured her. I bade her good night then, and made my way to Stoker's room. I was fatigued, but I could not, in all decency, avoid the conversation we needed to have on that pretext. I should, I knew, rest easier for having it over and done with. The clock was striking the hour as I raised my hand to rap upon Stoker's door. But just as I did so, I heard a gentle snore. He was already asleep, and if there was one thing he hated, it was being roused from his slumbers. I told myself it was out of consideration for his rest that I did not waken him, but it was the purest cowardice. I spent the next few minutes loathing myself vigorously as I returned to my room and prepared for bed. I ought not to have slept well, given all that weighed upon my conscience and the events of the evening, but I did. I passed peacefully into the arms of Morpheus, where I lay quite happily until the next morning, when hell itself seemed to break loose within Hathaway Hall. Chapter 18. I was first aware of some uproar when I left my room, having made my ablutions and dressed for the day. I had dressed in a becoming blue wool day dress, trimmed in black passementerie, and pinned my hair in a style Stoker particularly liked. I did not probe deeply into my motives in doing so, for fear I would discover I had made myself attractive in order to please a man, a disturbing notion, to be sure. That is the beginning of domestication, I told myself darkly as I descended the stairs. But before I could complete the thought, I heard raised voices from the direction of the great hall. Anjali was coming up the stairs and past me, carrying a watering pot. You are up and about your duties early, I said with a smile. She inclined her head in the direction of the great hall. It seemed best to give the Hathaways a little time to themselves this morning, she said, as Charles Hathaway's unmistakable voice rose. "Troubles?" I asked. She pressed her lips together. "I should not speak of it," she said, with great tact. "Besides, you will hear of it soon enough." I searched her face. She seemed paler than usual, but otherwise none the worse for her nocturnal adventure. "I hope you are quite recovered from last night." She ducked her head. "I feel very foolish. Anyone might have fainted at seeing such a thing," I assured her. I tipped my head thoughtfully. "I suppose you went outside for a cigarette?" She flushed. "Lady Hathaway does not mind, but Mrs. Hathaway would be very upset if she knew that I indulged." I laid a hand upon her arm. "Your secret is safe with me." A tiny smile played about her lips. "You are very kind, Miss Speedwell." She stepped aside, and I passed her then, bracing myself for whatever uproar might be in evidence. When I entered, I saw Stoker, sitting quietly at his place, consuming a vast amount of kedgeree whilst Charles thundered.
"I cannot believe this, the blackguard, the very devil!"
He caught sight of me and flushed.
"My apologies for my language, Miss Speedwell. It appears my brother,"
he larded the word with sarcasm,
"has disappeared."
My heart thudded, striking my ribs so loudly I was certain they must have heard the thump. "Disappeared?" I asked, arranging my face in a quizzical expression.
"No note, no explanation. He has simply vanished from the house."
Charles lapsed into silence as he threw himself into his chair. His plate was full, but he pushed it away uneaten. From her seat, Mary Hathaway sipped quietly at her tea, while Effie sat buttering slices of toast she did not eat, piling them at the edge of her plate. "Surely he has simply gone to town," I began.
"He did not order the carriage," Mary said, setting her cup down with a gentle clink, "which means he must have crossed the moor in the dark. His bed was undisturbed," she added primly. "And Cranner is convinced he must have fallen to his death in the bogs," Effie put in.
"Euphemia,"
Charles said in a warning tone.
"Well, it is what she thinks,"
Effie protested. She looked at me.
"But there is more."
Something in her face warned me before she said the words. "The jewels," I breathed.
"Yes,"
Charles said grimly.
"He has gone, and the Eye of the Dawn has vanished with him."
Breakfast was an uncomfortable meal. Stoker said little, and Mary Hathaway even less, but there was an unpleasant serenity to her, as if something of a mess had been tidied away to her satisfaction. Justifiably distressed, Lady Hathaway had rung for breakfast in her room, carried by the faithful Anjali, and so we were free to speculate on what might have happened. The Hathaways seemed inclined to follow the dictates of Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is the likeliest. And the simplest explanation was that Jonathan Hathaway had helped himself to his grandmother's diamond and left.
"I suppose he might have taken it to be valued," Effie suggested.
"It is not his to take,"
Charles reminded her coldly.
"And for God's sake, stop buttering toast if you don't mean to eat it."
Effie surveyed the pile of buttered toast.
"Don't scold, Charles. I will put it out for the pigs," she said in a contrite tone. "It will not go to waste."
Charles made a harrumphing sound. Stoker cleared his throat and addressed Charles.
"In view of the current distractions, I think it best if Miss Speedwell and I return to London at once. You will not want strangers in your midst just now."
Charles gave him a narrow look.
But you will take the thylacine, on Lord Rosmoren's behalf?
Before Stoker could reply, Mary Hathaway spoke up.
I say, take it with you. I doubt his lordship could resist the beast once he's seen it, if it is as remarkable as you say. And then perhaps his lordship might see his way to giving it proper pride of place when his museum is complete. Perhaps even a Hathaway wing?
She suggested. For all her pretenses to gentility, Mary Hathaway had the keen instincts of a merchant, I realized. She had realized how much likelier Lord Rosmoren was to keep the trophy once it was already in his possession. A fait accompli, and it was apparent that she harboured a wish to associate the Hathaway name with the far more august Rosmoren title. Stoker nodded.
Certainly, if you wish. I will build a suitable crate and pack it up this morning.
Mary excused herself to supervise Mrs. Desmond in the stillroom with the making of jam, whilst Charles went to find a railway timetable. Much discussion of trains followed before Stoker turned to me.
I trust that meets with your approval, Veronica.
I blinked. I had been wool-gathering, and for all I knew, he was asking if I wanted to take a slow train to John O'Groats. I forced a smile. Of course, I haven't much to pack. I need only finish the list of the butterflies I believe Lord Rosmoren should acquire, and I shall be entirely ready.
Very well,
Charles Hathaway said as he rose.
If you will excuse me, I have things to do. The farm work will not wait simply because my brother decided to play the villain.
He rose and threw down his napkin. Effie, who had been watching silently, collected his full plate and her own, and excused herself to the piggery.
Do you suppose the pigs got at him?
Stoker asked conversationally. I beg your pardon? I surveyed him across the breakfast table.
Pigs. They're notoriously voracious eaters.
But an entire man? He shrugged.
Simplest thing in the world for a pen full of hungry porkers.
I pushed aside my plate, staring suspiciously at the sausages as I did so. That is revolting.
That is nature,
he said, finishing his kedgeree. He regarded me over the rim of his teacup.
You realize this means the fellow we have known as Jonathan Hathaway can be no such person.
To busy my nerveless fingers, I took up a piece of toast and began to butter it. Why do you say that?
If he has taken the trouble to steal a jewel he was meant to inherit anyway, he is clearly an impostor. And that would explain why you were uncertain of his identity, as were his relations.
Lady Hathaway believes in him, I said.
Lady Hathaway is elderly, and no doubt sees what she wants to see.
He returned. He sat back in his chair and gave me a long, level look.
The more important question is, who is this man pretending to be Jonathan Hathaway?
The butter knife slipped through my fingers and crashed onto my plate. He went on.
Well, I suppose it hardly matters now.
Doesn't it? I asked, retrieving the knife and plunging it once more into the butter. It was easy to pretend it was Harry Spenlove's heart, I thought darkly.
The theft of the jewel is a family matter, not a criminal one, since Lady Hathaway certainly does not mean to bring charges,
he said evenly.
Whether he ever returns again, or simply vanishes into the night with his diamond, he cannot be arrested unless Lady Hathaway insists, and that will clearly not happen. So,
he finished with a broad smile,
That means we have survived this little favour to Sir Hugo without being stabbed, abducted, shot, or otherwise assaulted. I shall consider that a victory.
As soon as Stoker had prepared the thylacine, we made our goodbyes, and the household saw us off. Lady Hathaway and Anjali stood at her ladyship's window, waving, while Mary brought her children to lisp an interminable farewell poem. Every time one of them forgot a line, she made them begin again, until at last I could bear it no longer. "What clever children!" I exclaimed, interrupting them with a bright smile. "Stoker, I think they deserve some of your excellent honey drops." His expression darkened.
"This tin is the last of them,"
he protested in a whisper. "Sometimes sacrifices must be made for the general good," I returned. I put out my hand for the tin. He rummaged in his pocket before handing over the candy with ill grace. I plucked a large piece out for each child, cramming it into their greedy mouths before Mary Hathaway could protest. Instantly, the gooey mess stuck their little teeth together, rendering them blessedly silent. I handed the tin back to Stoker, who would have sulked, except for the fact that a pair of strapping farmhands was just emerging from the hall with his trophy. He supervised their handling of it as they secured the crate on the back of the carriage. He leapt up, clearly intending to ride thusly to the station at Shepton Parva, perched next to his beloved thylacine with the air of Achilles, gloating over the still warm body of Hector. Before I could remonstrate with him, Effie emerged from the house, carrying a large wooden box. She thrust it into my startled hands.
"The orrery," she said, flushing.
Charles gave her a surprised look.
"Why, Effie,"
he began. The expression on her face would have suited one of the lesser martyred saints.
"I know it has to go, Charles. You are quite right. But I cannot bear to keep it if I am only going to lose it in the end."
"Well, I think you might have it for another month or two," he said kindly. "Lord Rosmoren may not even offer for it."
"Then let him have the thing," she burst out. "If I am not permitted to study, then Granfer's instruments are a mockery. They should all be cleared away."
She flicked me a glance.
"Goodbye, Miss Speedwell. I think you meant to be kind."
I had not time to reply before she returned to the house, clearly on the verge of tears. Charles Hathaway looked a little embarrassed, but his embarrassment was tinged with relief.
"It seems she is benefiting from your helpful example, my dove," he said to his wife.
Mary was too busy applying a damp handkerchief to her children's faces to respond. We said our farewells and I clambered into the carriage, clutching the unwieldy box. The driver clicked his tongue at the horse, and the conveyance lurched into motion. I turned to wave farewell at the assembled Hathaways, feeling as though we had just made a timely escape, but from what I could not say. Mary fussed over her children under her spouse's genial eye. It would never occur to him to help, I reflected, as she darted after little Geoffrey, who slipped eel-like out of her grasp. Anjali and Lady Hathaway had already disappeared, but as we bowled along the drive, I saw a gingery head at the window of the observatory. Effie must have fairly run up the stairs to watch us leave, I realised, and she remained there as long as the carriage was in sight, until the little rise of the hills beyond carried us away from Hathaway Hall and its curious inhabitants.